Welcome to Geopolitical Horizons, the podcast from geopolity.com. Geopolity will soon be publishing its annual report, Strategic Estimate 2026. It will be out on the 31st of December. Our analysts have worked hard following the key events of the past year, pursuing trends and patterns in order to give you their analysis and insight. I've had the privilege of getting a preview of the report, and I have Geopolity founder Adnan Khan here with me today to discuss this report. Adnan, how are we keeping? How are you doing?
I'm good, Yusuf. I'm good. Doing well about myself.
Yeah, good. It's been a busy year. Let's get straight into it. So, Adnan, what is the main theme of the report this year? I know you like to do a particular theme every year. What's the main theme of this year's report?
So, yeah, the theme we're going with this year is really the slaughtering of the West sacred cow. So, you know, the values, these underlying principles you never question, because by default, people believe in them. And, you know, this year, whether it's TikTok to Gaza, from universities to cults, what we're seeing is, you know, international law, the global liberal order, everything that was the bedrock of Western civilization. What we're seeing this year, 2025, these sacred cows have been completely slaughtered. And this is obviously going to have lots of ramifications. So that is really the central theme of this year's strategic estimate.
So it's interesting, you're talking about the sacred cows. Has it got anything to do with Trump? He's been in power for almost a year now.
Yes, it has a lot to do with Donald Trump, although obviously this issue did start before Donald Trump. And you're right, I think soon, end of January, will be his year in office. And as far as Trump's concerned, he's coming to do a revolution, not just in America, but the whole world, the Trump revolution. It was unfinished business in his first term. So as far as he's concerned, in his second term, he wants to really continue where he started and really see through the Trump revolution. So this is, you know, getting rid of the global liberal order, putting America first, getting America's economy sorted, dealing with immigration, getting out of all these forever wars. And, you know, his first year has been pretty patchy as well.
Do you think the whole MAGA movement is actually imploding on itself?
Yeah, so this is probably one of the main developments of the year. So, you know, just for the audience, MAGA, Make America Great Again, this was the movement that Trump managed to turn into his support base. So these are Americans who just lost hope in America. These are conservatives who felt that conservatism is going in the wrong direction. And Trump really managed to win these guys over. And these guys have become his support base. But these guys had huge expectations of Donald Trump. The expectation was he's going to defend conservatism. He's going to bring back religion. He's going to deal with America's forever wars. He's really going to put America first and central to everything. However, what we've seen this year is a divide right down the middle is evolving. It's actually getting worse. People like Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson was an open advocate of Trump. And even he now has done a U-turn on a couple of things. What happened with Charlie Kirk really showed us that there are major differences. The things they're differing over are immigration, are Jeffrey Epstein, and Israel. And in fact, Israel, shockingly this year, is at the center of all the sacred cows, really, that are being slaughtered. So, you know, MAGA had this hope in Trump. He's going to see through all of the promises he made. And as he's doing U-turns on a few of them, and as he's not delivering on them, what we're seeing is a major divide opening up between his base. And, you know, that's not good for Trump in the long run. And, you know, if Trump was able to whip up support from so many people and he doesn't deliver and there's a divide, then really, you know, we keep hearing this term of civil war in America. We could really see that. You know, if the people are not happy that their interests are not being taken care of and the country's not going in the right direction, you know, this usually tells us of the trouble ahead.
So, interestingly, your report covers a country that we don't really hear on the news that much, Somalia, and you've termed it one of America's forever wars. Why is this particular issue covered? What do we need to know about it?
So, the reason why we've covered this is Somalia is an example of a war America's involved in, and it goes against everything Trump's been saying. So this year, 2025, America has bombed Somalia 101 times. We still have 4 weeks left until the end of the year, and there's a likely chance it's going to be bombed more. Now, any country that's been bombed 100 times plus, you would have heard about it. There would have been some sort of controversy about it. I mean, 100 bombing attacks, you know, you're in full-blown war. And Somalia, America's actually been at war in this country since actually the 1980s. It's a war that they can't seem to win. You know, people who are old enough will remember Black Hawk Down. That was when people realized we have American troops in Somalia who were completely slaughtered, really, by the militias out there. But what America's done since then, it stayed there. It's utilized the surrounding countries. So Somalia, we go through the history. We go through what the American strategy is. The main thing is this is the exact war Trump spoke out against. These are the exact wars Trump said he wants to end. But actually, he supported drone attacks and attacks against Somalia. 101 attacks have taken place up to this point.
On the topic of ending wars, Trump keeps making this claim that he has ended 7 wars. Which wars has he ended?
Right. So, yeah, Trump can't stop mentioning this. He stopped mentioning it now because I think he's realized he's not going to get the Nobel Peace Prize. I think that was the whole thing behind it. So what Trump is saying, the 7 wars is ended. So the Israel-Iran war, the Serbia-Kosovo war, you got Ethiopia-Egypt, you got Cambodia at war at the moment, you've got Congo at war as well. Armenia, Azerbaijan, and he's saying he's actually the one that's brought them to an end. No one else has been able to bring these to an end, so he deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. But really, if you look at these, there's 3 things that are common to all of these 7 wars. The first thing is Trump's actual role is highly debatable. It's highly debatable that his actions is what's led to the end of these wars. Secondly, most of the wars, what you find is there's actually been no conclusion, no peace deal. If you look at Armenia, Azerbaijan, there's so many issues that still haven't been addressed yet. If you look at Iran and Israel, well, they've just stopped missiles going on each other. The differences between them, the issues, none of that's actually been resolved. And the third common thing you actually find is, you know, some of these countries, there's not actually a war going on. So there's actually no war going on between Egypt and Ethiopia. So what war did you end when there's actually no war going on? Azerbaijan and Armenia had ended their war, and then Trump came along, and Trump's trying to take credit for it. And this is a common thing we're seeing with Trump. He's claiming lots of victories which are not from him, and he's trying to deflect away criticism that are going against him. And it's classic Trump. You know, he's the best president ever. He's the greatest ever. He can end every war. However, like Trump likes to make things up, this is another thing he's actually making up. And it's funny, no one really calls him out on it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a section in your report called Emperor Trump. And I'm guessing the reference is Emperor's New Clothes. Is that what you were going for?
Absolutely. So what we do in that chapter is we look at all the characteristics Trump likes to promote himself with. So, and we look at them because, you know, the main thing with Trump is it's not about institutions for him. It's not about ideology for him. It's not about principles. It's all about his personality and the traits he has. So what you find is he's a retributionist. He's going after people that he didn't like. So if you remember the FBI investigation that happened in his first term, Mr. Comey, he was the FBI head who had to look into the investigation. Yes. He had to look into Trump. Trump now has taken him to court just to actually get revenge on him. The head of the labor statistics in America, the lady published a report on how the labor statistics aren't very great. So Trump basically got sacked. Trump's gang after the Federal Reserve. So what you're finding is Trump's rule is very personality driven. There's no place for ideology. There's no place for principles. If you look at Trump, he's actually using the National Guard in areas which are run by the Democrats. That's how he's actually dealing with them. So what we do in this chapter, we call him the Emperor because, you know, the Emperor is above the law. The Emperor is the symbol of a nation. And that's what Trump wants to be. Trump doesn't want to strengthen American institutions. That's the last thing he wants to do. Trump doesn't even want to strengthen the opposition. What Trump wants is he is America. He would rather it was him standing on the Statue of Liberty rather than the lady who's actually there. So we go through around 10 of his characteristics and show what he's actually done. And it's actually quite scary if you think about it. You've got a guy here, you know, there's no place for law and order. There's no place for things that he doesn't like. You know, his rule is very personality driven, like we see with third world rulers or like we see with autocrats.
So enough about America internally. Let's talk about some of the other topics that you were going through in your report. So there was one point or one section about the US and Venezuela. And will the US invade Venezuela? What are your thoughts on that? Can you give the audience a little bit of an insight?
For George W. Bush, he will forever be remembered with the Iraq invasion. And Trump, he looks as though now he will be, whatever the outcome is, he'll be remembered for Venezuela. America's largest aircraft carrier is now in the vicinity of Venezuela. They're ramping up the pressure on Maduro. The leader of Venezuela has actually reached out that we're prepared to sell you oil, we're prepared to talk. They're not interested. Now, what we do is we look at a bit of a past, present, future with Venezuela. The American companies, the energy companies, they were the ones that built Venezuela's energy industry. And in the 70s, I think it was, there was a coup and the new leader, he nationalized all the industry. So American energy companies have always been very, very unhappy with Venezuela. They effectively, I mean, Venezuela has the largest oil reserves currently. When Hugo Chavez came to power in the late 1990s, he really went down this anti-American route. And since then, really, there's been a lot of animosity between America and Venezuela. So America has already put sanctions on Venezuela. Venezuela is already under not just an arms embargo, a full economic embargo. In fact, many people are leaving Venezuela because the country is basically collapsed. And now what you're seeing is America, or Trump actually, is looking to invade. So for Trump, this is an easy victory. It's obviously in the Caribbean. It's not in the Middle East. However, look, you know, we've been there before where wars look easy on paper. And, you know, you go in and in 20 years, you're there. So I think, I mean, there's a possibility by the end of 2025, the war's actually already happened. I think I can't see the Venezuelans withstanding any American onslaught. Where the challenge for America begins, if you overthrow the regime, what are you going to replace it with? You know, the age-old question again. In Iraq and Afghanistan, these were complete disasters. So what Trump might find, the war is the easy bit. The post-war bit is going to be the more difficult bit. But again, here we are again, talking about America going to war. They're calling these Venezuelans narco-terrorists. In fact, Trump is saying that Maduro, the head of Venezuela, he's the leader of a narco-cartel. No evidence ever presented, no nothing. This is the argument he's going on. And, you know, we've been here before.
So let's move over to Russia. Can Trump make Russia kneel? Even that question itself, thinking it's probably not the right question because Trump and Putin seem to be very close.
Trump wants Russia to kneel. He's been offering everything. Since he came into power, he said that this is, if he was in power, this war would have never happened. He said, we've been wasting money giving it to Ukraine. And he said, within 24 hours, he's going to have ended the war. Clearly, that hasn't happened. And the reason why it hasn't happened is they've made offers to Russia. Russia's position is, if we are winning, if we are bleeding Ukraine, why do we need to negotiate? Why do we need to end it? We could take more land. So what Putin's been doing, he's been meeting Trump. He met him in Alaska. There's probably going to be further meetings coming up. But as far as Putin's concerned, they don't really need to negotiate. They're in a strong win position. They could take more land. So what Trump's been trying to do is he's been trying to make so many different offers of strategic deals on the Arctic, strategic deals in Eurasia, on energy, on technology, in the hope that Russia will end the war. And then they can start talking about other global issues. So we've gone with the title, can he make Russia kneel? Doesn't look like at the moment.
I mean, I was reading today that they've asked Ukraine to vacate all the cities in the Donbass region. I don't know if I'm following that correctly. So he seems like he's fully sided with Russia and giving them literally everything that they really want.
Yeah, I mean, this has been Trump's position for quite a while, even in between these two presidencies, that just let them take what they have and we'll give some sort of security deal to Ukraine. But what Trump's doing is he's basically just blaming Ukraine for everything. Because of you, the war happened. Because of you, the war's continuing. Because of you, America's in debt. Because of you, Russia's gone to war. And effectively, you're right. What Trump has said is, look, the Donbass has been lost. This should go to Russia. So let's just make a deal on the rest of the land. Now, if that was going to be the American position, then there would have been no point for Ukraine to have gone war from day one. Ukraine should never have fought Russia if they were going to give up land. The whole idea was you'd keep land, you'd keep the land or try and get it back. So it seems Trump is batting for Russia at the moment rather than Ukraine. You know, that's the world we're in at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's been going on for almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years in February. Is it pretty much like a stalemate in terms of the war itself? And is it purely now negotiations?
So interestingly, in February, it will be 4 years. In June, if we get that far, the Ukraine war would be longer than World War One. That's how long it's actually been going on for. Ukraine is completely dependent upon Western arms, weapons, finance, support. It can't fight the war without them. And Trump is calling it a day. And the Europeans, despite their rhetoric, really, they have no capability. Russia has thrown lots of resources at the war, is getting help from China, is still selling energy to other countries. And look, how does Russia win wars? Russia starts badly, then it throws loads of troops at the war, and it wins very ugly. It did that in World War II. It did that in Chechnya. It's doing it again. And this has always been the Russian strategy, that when you lose interest, we're still going to be here. So at the end of the day, Ukraine was never going to win this unless the West were going to support them. And look, Western support, ask the Kurds, ask other factions, and they'll tell you what that means. It's not worth the money. It's not worth the paper it's written on. The West will support you when it's in their interest, and they will abandon you when their interests have been achieved. So, you know, it's unfortunate for the Ukrainians. You know, after 4 years, you're going to have to give up territory anyway. Now, you could have just done that from day one. But the West made so many promises, you know, as long as it will take, we're there to the end, not any more. So, you know, if you look at it from a military perspective, Ukraine is just completely dependent upon foreign support. And that's his problem. Whilst the Russians have their capabilities, they have their industries. And yes, you know, it's not like the Russians haven't felt any pain. They have, but, you know, you can't really compare the two. Russia's a huge country, has its own energy, has its own military industry. Ukraine doesn't. So despite the odd victories it's having with drones, with missiles, these are not altering the battlefield reality.
So Russia, yeah, it's in a strong position in Ukraine, but in other areas is actually losing influence. So it's been a year now since Bashar Assad, who was supported by Russia, the Russians weren't able to save him. What's Russia's status now in Syria with Jalani?
So yes, Russia carried out some strikes when the rebels launched the assault from the north of the country down to Damascus. And they realized pretty quickly that there's nothing much they can do. So what Russia did at the time, a year ago, they prioritized their military assets. So what they did was they put all the assets in the two bases they have on the coastal areas of Syria. And in fact, they actually moved a lot of their military equipment and military personnel out. So really, since a year ago, Russia's had quite a minimal presence in Syria. However, their two bases, they still had them. It's a naval base and an air base. And there's been a bit of a question mark what's going to happen with them. So just a few weeks ago, Ahmad al-Sharaa, he visited Moscow. Shockingly, the country, the leader that supported your opposition, that carried out untold atrocities. He went to Moscow, he shook his hands, and you know, he was very open that, look, we want to maintain the relationship that the previous regime had. And actually, he says you can keep the bases. That's not a problem. I suspect, look, Ahmad al-Sharaa is doing this because he has other issues. And one of them is Israel. Israel is expanding into Syria. And he feels having a Russian military presence is probably a bit of a guarantee for him. So, you know, we've come a long way. A year ago, the Russians were on the side of Bashar al-Assad. Not anymore. Now they've changed and they're on the side of Ahmad al-Sharaa. So the reason why Syria is important for Russia, it actually has nothing to do with Syria itself. Russia's presence in Africa, all of it goes through the bases in Syria. So in Mali, in Libya, and all these other African Sahel countries. So if they lose Syria, now they've got a problem in terms of getting their troops and getting their equipment to Africa. So Syria is really their supply chain. that allow that to happen. And that's why the two bases they've got are really important from that perspective.
Another area that's very important to Russia is the Caucasus. But do you think Russia is actually losing influence there? Do you feel like they're becoming more allied with America and NATO?
So famously, the leader of Azerbaijan, Armenia, that went in the White House, Trump took credit. He brought the war to an end. I mean, some very interesting things came out of the agreement between both countries. One of them is they've agreed to give America rare earth element resources. So that now means American companies are going to come in. They're going to mine this in the ground, which means there's going to be an American corporate presence. So the other thing that Trump's done, he's agreed to actually build a trade route. So it's actually been going to be called the Trump route for freedom or the Trump route for prosperity. But what that does now, it means that there's an actual American presence. And the Caucasus is one of those strategic issues for Russia. It's a vital issue for Russia. The Caucasus area, you know, Chechnya, this area, there's a lot of discontent. And so America's now got in there. So what's really happened is Russia's just tied down in Ukraine. Ukraine's so important. So they took the ball off Syria. Look at what's happened there. And now they took their eyes off the Caucasus. So this is a big problem for Russia. You know, you might win the Ukraine war, but if the expense of that is you're losing in other areas, then that's not really a good sign.
I just can't help thinking Trump likes to put his name on everything. And it goes back to the Emperor Trump chapter. There's a chapter titled Russia Between China and the US. And I found this chapter actually quite interesting in the way you put things. Could you outline what this means?
In the past, in the 60s, America had this strategy where they were able to win China over to themselves, to the Western camp, and they managed to divide them from Russia. The Chinese and the Russians had a very difficult relationship, but America was able to win them over. And funny enough, that victory where they won Chinese over is eventually what led to their development and where China is today as a power. What America's been looking to do for some time, and Brzezinski said this when he was alive before he passed away, that an alliance between China and Russia, both of them could pose significant problems for America. So if you could divide them in any way, that would be very useful. So one of the things the American policymakers have been talking about is doing what's called a reverse Nixon, where this time they win the Russians away from China. And then you have China on their own. So what Trump is doing and what Biden, the previous leader, have been trying to do for some time is if we could make some offers to Russia where they then work with the West give them a stake in Eurasia, then that leaves China on their own. So the Russians are really in between two powers, China and America. And they need to decide what side they want to be on. For the moment, Russia has a very good relationship with China. Russia has no problem talking to them. As far as Russia's concerned, we're a power. It's natural for other powers want to talk to us. So they have no problem talking to America. They have no problem making agreements. If you want them to do that at the expense of China, well, they're not up for that. So America's really going to have to offer them something. So we go through some of the possibilities and why this would really, really help America. And the Americans are pretty confident. They did this once before. They achieved this by separating China from Russia back in the day. So in that chapter, we go through that. And, you know, this is something you've got to keep in mind that Russia, it does have this superiority complex that they've never been seen as a power. The European imperialists, they always see Russia as inferior. So for them, that's why the West have always been able to use Russia when they need them. You know, they're enemies, but when we go to war, we'll take you with us because we need your troops and we need your industries and things like that. So, you know, the Russians have this thing. So that's what America's trying to play on. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. I think it's going to be difficult because Russia's relationship actually runs quite deep. It's very deep and very broad.
So moving on to China, you have a section in your report about China. How are they dealing with the tariff war? If you could touch on that for us.
So China's response to the tariff war has to some degree been perfect. They've done exactly what they should have done, which is the complete opposite to what most other countries are doing. What China's done is, look, we don't want to fight. We want to trade. But if we are forced to fight, we're prepared to. So when America put tariffs on China, they responded with the same tariffs. When Trump then threw a fit and said, how dare you, we're going to put additional tariffs on, China said, fine, we're going to put them on as well. To teach America a lesson, what they said is we're going to restrict rare earth element exports to America. And that's when Trump said, oh, let's talk. He didn't think through his strategy. So China, with what, 90% of rare earth elements are processed in China. If China don't give them to you, your industry, your military industry, your F-35 jets, your high-tech military equipment, you will not have the resources for it. So now talks are still going on and no final deal has been made yet. But what this shows is China is not rolling over. If you look at other countries, they gave in to America. In fact, Ireland, Indonesia have actually said that they were specifically told not just to reduce their tariffs with America, but to decouple from China. So this trade war with the world that Trump is doing, a lot of it is actually about China. They want countries to decouple from China. And then America will make agreements with them, but because America is more powerful, we'll get more out of the agreement than these countries.
Pakistan and India went to war in May for a few short days, I think it was. Was China the real winner?
Absolutely, absolutely. This was the first war, real-world example we have of Chinese military equipment being used in a real-war setting. Until now, we see their navy, we see their missiles, we see the aircraft carriers. They look great on TV, they look great on YouTube videos, but they've not been tested. Pakistan technically went to war with Chinese jets, Chinese missiles, Chinese cyber equipment, and really what it showed was India, who had French and American military equipment, and the Pakistani had the Chinese came out on top. If you take your mind back, some of the wars between Israel and the Middle East countries, Israel was armed by America and the Middle East countries were armed by the Soviet Union. So this was seen as wars by the two powers and Israel came out on top. So what it showed is the Western military equipment was better than the Soviets. That's basically what we've had. So really, the real winner in the Pakistan-India war was actually China.
Let's move over to Europe. You've got a section on Europe. So there's a section in there titled Europe's Century of Humiliation. I think it refers back to China's century of humiliation. What's the thinking behind that?
So Europe faces a strategic problem. America is abandoning it. America's saying you need to bear the burden. If you want to support the Ukrainians, you better arm them and fund them. And so the help America's been giving them, they've had enough. In fact, the whole Trump electoral campaign wars, we've had enough of picking up the burden for other countries. You've got to stand on your own feet. So he keeps, talking about NATO, how NATO's useless. So Europe's got a problem now. The Europeans really, for the last 70 years, have cut their defense industry, cut their military, because America is going to protect us. America's saying now, no, we're not. You're on your own. So Europeans have a problem. If they want to help Ukraine by defeating Russia, they're going to have to increase their military budgets. They're going to have to increase their size of their armies. In fact, just this week, the French now have said they're bringing in a form of conscription. The Germans, the Dutch, the Belgium have already said they're bringing in a type of conscription. So what that means is they are expecting to cut their welfare budgets. They're expecting to cut their education budget to fund the military. So Europeans really need to make a decision. If you want to be on America's side, then you better make these sacrifices, which are going to be deeply unpopular. If America now is not the right partner, then it's time for you to bail out. Now, that's unthinkable for the Europeans. But America has put them on notice. So if you remember the signal chat that was going on between the American administration, where they were talking down to Europe. That's what these guys think about Europe. So Europe needs to now choose. What Europe doesn't want to do is you're going to war with Russia. The Americans have now said it's Ukraine's fault. The Americans will throw them in the future. If they're going to sacrifice for America, America is not reliable. So that's why, the next few years is really going to determine if this is going to be the century of humiliation for the Europeans.
I mean, with this all going on, do you feel like Europe is actually going to go towards China?
So from an interest perspective, they should be. China is already reaching out to them. China is making better offer to them. China is saying, we will sell you our technology, the next generation of tech. The problem they're having is mentally, intellectually, they are aligned with America and they can't see life without America. So the Americans are saying to the Europeans that in the Cold War, they drew a line from Norway down to Turkey. That was a frontline battle in the Cold War. So the Europeans were on the front line. So America helped them. The next war with China, that's going to be in the Pacific. The Europeans don't have a border in the Pacific. So America's view of the European role is, your job is to make sure you do not give China access to the European market. They shouldn't be making money from the European market. If the Europeans do that, you are starting your own deindustrialization. The Chinese are making electronic vehicles, next generation jets, the green technology. They can sell it to the Europeans. They can actually cooperate with the Europeans. If they don't give the Chinese access to this market, well, the European industries are in no position to be making these goods. In fact, Volkswagen and Mercedes have accepted they cannot compete with China when it comes to electric vehicles. China can just make it cheaper. So really, they should be joining them. But obviously, there's a long history here. They see themselves as ideologically aligned with America, although the Americans don't see themselves ideologically aligned with the Europeans.
In recent years, we've seen the rise of the right, and this is something that's covered in the report. What are its conclusions?
So the main thing really is you can see across Europe, the right are not just rising, but a lot of them are getting into coalition governments. In the EU, you have a right-wing party. Marine Le Pen's party in France has come close. She's taken the presidency into the second round. But the right, they have some views which are highly debatable. You know, for them, immigration is the problem. The problem in our countries is there's too many people, there's too many immigrants, we're letting too many of them in, our countries are completely changing. However, the first thing is many of these countries, you find that they're in demographic decline anyway, so they need immigration. But it's highly debatable how much of the problem is immigration when 80 to 90% of the wealth in European countries is in the hands of like 1 to 10% of people. There's your problem. You've got a wealth distribution problem. So the report really finds that a lot of the arguments don't stack up. And actually, there's even division amongst the right. Some of the right wing believe there should be some immigration. We should get talented people in. Others are just completely racist. There should be no immigration whatsoever. But the real issue you've got here is why are the elites of European countries allowing the right to get mainstream coverage? Because really, if you look, you had financial crisis 2008, you had a decade of austerity that led to a cost of living crisis. The governments have created half the crisis that people are facing. So to deflect from this, what they're saying is, are the problems immigration? Are the problems all these foreigners coming in? The problem is these illegal boats that are coming over, even though immigration and illegal boats make up a very tiny element of the population. So what we find by looking at this whole phenomenon of the rise of the right wing is a lot of this is really a deflection from the real underlying issues.
We touched on earlier the point about rare earth elements. There's a section covered in the report about this and the geopolitics around it. What are the conclusions?
It's very interesting. You know, rare earth elements is all the rage now. Everyone's talking about it. It's become really, really important. The main thing really is when it comes to production, when it comes to processing, when it comes to refining, really China's doing about 90% of this. So these minerals that are necessary for modern tech, a lot of these are in the hands of China. So if China cuts supply, you are going to have a problem. And this is not something the West are going to resolve within 10 to 20 years. It's going to take a long, long time. And the reason why China got into this and got into this position is because they wanted to, in the 80s, be an industry leader in one industry. So they picked this one because nobody wanted to do it. It's very toxic. It's very labor intensive. It's very costly. The main thing is because of the pollution that comes from processing, Western countries didn't want to do it, you know, because of all the green agenda. So China did it, and now it's become critical. So again, rare earth elements is another arena of great power competition.
On the topic of tech, another big area is AI. What do you think is the future of AI?
So in this chapter, what we look at is there's two approaches emerging to AI. You've got the American approach and the European approach. And what we look at is, you know, it's a bit like when the internet first came in the mid-90s, there was very little regulation for it, and the regulation evolved over time. With AI, the West doesn't want to make that mistake again. So what we see happening is in America, Trump's come in, he's removing all the restrictions to AI development. The Europeans want to regulate it more, so they're bringing in rules and regulations and laws. So you're getting two different frameworks now. The American one is, we want to be the leader, let's remove everything. You've got to keep in mind, look, there's a lot of stuff about AI we don't know yet. There's a lot of hype, but, you know, what about privacy? What about how far it can go? Already with ChatGPT and these online tools, there's a lot of question marks about privacy, how it's used, how, you know, now writers are saying there's no role for them anymore. An AI can just write a book, give it a prompt, and it will do it for you. So what we do in this chapter, we look at the two emerging approaches. The other thing that's evolving is if you look at the architecture, you've got effectively American companies. You've got Google, you've got Meta, you've got Microsoft, you've got Amazon. So the future Western hemisphere, that's going to be dominated by America. Then you've got the Chinese tech that's developing for Asia. And so what you're going to get is hemispheric AI architecture. And, you know, there's more people in Asia, so there's more people for China, really, to use AI. So this is quite an important development. It's something we're going to be watching on the website going forward as well.
The final section in your report, it talks about the war in Gaza and that it is breaking the Israel and West alliance. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Israel really, you know, the two-year anniversary in October, you know, Israel was attacked on October 7th, but everyone's talking about genocide, starvation, torture, and how the Gazans are victims. In fact, Israel's credibility has hit complete rock bottom. If there's anything that's coming out of the last 2 years, is the problem is Israel. The word genocide has now been linked to Israel. So these people who were victims of a genocide back in the 40s, they're now being accused of carrying one out. And in the West, in America, Israel is becoming a dividing line. People are saying, not in our name, non-Muslims, people of the West, citizens who used to support Israel, they're now saying, our government should need to cut back and they shouldn't be doing this anymore. That's quite unique because Israel was supposed to be the outpost in the Middle East. It's the arm of Western civilization out in the Far East. But what's happened in the last 2 years is it's completely destroying the relationship between the two.
Finally, you always like to do a deep dive on every single strategic estimate. And the topic you've chosen this year is the Arctic. What makes this region important? Why did you pick this region to do as a deep dive? What do observers need to know about it?
Yeah, so we've gone with the Arctic this year because it's becoming more and more important. There's more and more activity taking place. And actually, the Arctic was outside global competition for most of history. Not anymore. So it's a shorter trade route when you go from the Far East and you come to the West. That now means you have to traverse close to Russia. The ice is melting up there as well. And actually, there's energy up there as well. So you've got Russia, you've got the Scandinavian countries, you've got America, you've got the European countries. All of them want more and more resources, and all of them want access to the trade routes. Even Chinese and Russian military ships now are going through that area. So what we do, we have a look at the history of this area. We have a look at how the area's got to the importance it has. And then we have a look at the different countries involved. We have a look at some of the institutions that are involved, trying to develop a framework for it. And then we end with some conclusions, some points about what areas of conflict are likely going to occur. But, you know, usually Middle East, the Far East, Africa, Europe, you got the Americas. Now you have to add the Arctic to, you have to add the Arctic to the world. It's an area that the world's going to compete with.
Thanks for your time today, Adnan. I really look forward to the full strategic estimate. You guys can download it on the 31st of December. That's the date it will be published. Also, keep an eye out for our 2026 forecast that will be coming out soon. Until next time, I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.